Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of New Books in Islamic Studies. I'm your host, Sher Ali Tareen. For each new episode, we choose an important new book in the field of Islamic studies and we chat with its author. Recent years have witnessed a spate of journalistic and popular writings on the looming threat to civilization that lurks in traditional Islamic seminaries or madrasas that litter the physical and intellectual landscape of the Muslim world. In his riveting new book, What is a Madrasa? Ibrahim Musa, Professor of History and Islamic Studies at the University of Notre Dame, challenges such sensationalist, stereotypical narratives by providing instead a nuanced and richly textured account of the place and importance of madrasas in Islam, both historically and in the contemporary moment. Rather than approaching madrasas from a policy studies viewpoint, as institutions requiring reform and modernization, this book instead examines madrasas on their own terms, with the view of highlighting their internal complexities and tensions. Focused primarily on the madrasas of South Asia, what makes this book particularly remarkable is the way it brings together the intellectual histories and traditions that define madrasa education and the everyday practices in madrasa life today. The reader of this book travels through an arcade of the seminal texts, scholars, and sites that have shaped the madrasa as an institution and its curricula over the last several centuries. But moreover, this book also provides readers with intimate portraits of daily life at madrasas through the eyes of students who study there, thus bringing into view the rhythms of everyday practices that punctuate the lives of madrasa students and the hopes, anxieties, and aspirations that irrigate their religious and social imaginaries. In our conversation, in addition to discussing these themes, we also talked about Professor Musa's own journey as a teenager in the madrasas of South Asia to the corridors of the American Academy. Written in an exceptionally lucid fashion, this book is essential reading for anyone interested in understanding the complexities of Muslim traditions of knowledge and education. It will also be particularly well suited for undergraduate and graduate seminars on Muslim intellectual thought, education, and on Islam in South Asia. Here now is my conversation with Professor Ibrahim Musa. Hello, Dr. Musa. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, Sher Ali. How are you?
Very good. Thank you so much, Dr. Musa, for your time and a wonderful book, wonderfully written. And it does multiple things. It provides us with an excellent historical narrative of madrasas in South Asia and elsewhere. It gives us an excellent ethnography of what happens in classrooms and madrasa today in India and in Pakistan. And it also talks about the geopolitics of madrasa. So it does multiple things and wonderfully written and brimming with insight. So thank you so much for this wonderful book and for your time today.
Well, you're very generous, and thank you for having me on your program.
So we have a tradition of New Books in Islamic Studies that our first question is always biographical. Mm-hmm. My two-part question to you would be, first of all, how did you become a scholar of Islam, which in this case is actually quite relevant to this book also, and we'll talk more about that as the interview proceeds. And secondly, how did you come to write this particular book?
Yeah, I think that, you know, when I start becoming aware of who I am and what I am, I mean, I think, you know, born and raised in South Africa, the question of your existential presence in South Africa as a person of a brown skin in a white-dominated South Africa with a large, vast majority of people of African heritage in apartheid South Africa, where things, where people were discriminating against people of color. People like myself, and I think I'm not the only one, always had to ask this question, who are you and what are you? And it's for many people, or at least for a few people that I know, the question of religion became an identity marker. And in my case, it was a certain set of doubts about what is Islam in an encounter with a colleague of mine at school who was a Jehovah's Witness, and he made a series of criticism of Islam, and that got me thinking. And so I started, you know, thinking, you know, the stuff that I know as a student who goes to equivalent of Sunday school, I was reading books on Islam, but some of those questions, those nagging questions about how do I understand this tradition, really were not forthcoming. And I realized that I needed many more tools than just reading books in order to understand that. And then I got involved with the Tablighi Jamaat, which is a Islamic evangelical movement. They gave me spiritual solace, but the intellectual question still remained. And that's how I then persuaded my parents that they should give me permission to go study Islam in India. And this book is actually a way in which I want to explain that journey. But, you know, in a post 9/11 world, it also became necessary as a defense of the madrasa. So in another title for this book would have been In Defense of the Madrasa. And so it is basically trying to hopefully share with a larger public, a public both people within Muslim communities, but also for other faith communities and other interested parties, as to what the work madrasas do and why the criticism of madrasas as places of terrorism and radicalism is a very flawed analysis and is not the entire story.
So could you tell us a bit more about your own journey in the madrasas in India as a young boy? And how do you think your journey and experience is reflective of some of the strengths, potentialities, and also some of the shortcomings of a madrasa education?
Well, you know, my journey was one of a restless person. So I was very restless. I wanted things to get done. Everywhere I went to a madrasa, I always saw this shortcoming or that shortcoming. And what do I mean by shortcoming? So first of all, I went there very unequipped in terms of languages. I could read the Quran, but I had no Arabic language. I couldn't speak any Indian language except a very, very broken version of Gujarati. And so it's a period of 6 years in which I craft my own curriculum unintentionally. So I started with a madrasa in Baruch in Gujarat, where I learned basic Arabic and Urdu, and I quickly realized, you know, Gujarat is not the kind of the heart of where Islam is studied. I always heard of Deoband. Deoband is the kind of the equivalent of the Harvard or the main kind of intellectual place in South Asia where Islam is studied. So after 1 year in Gujarat, I head out for Deoband. Now I'm in the kind of playing in the big league, so to speak. But the big league school is not the place where you get the kind of best attention, right? It's like, you know, when you go to a liberal arts school, there's a lot of attention on the part of faculty towards the student. Now you're in a very big place. Now you have to find your own way through that. Luckily, I had that zeal. I had that kind of discipline. And I made my way through the curricular process. The great advantage of going through going to a place like Deoband, such a large place, and in being on this voyage of mine, a lot of adventure in it too, is that you get to encounter a number of players and people that you would not normally encounter if you follow the set ways. So I quickly got exposure to some of the, you know, major scholars in Deoband: Mufti Mahmood Gangohi, Qari Muhammad Tayyab, Maulana Madani, not Hussein Ahmed Madani, but his son, and Asad Madani and that whole family. So quickly I got exposure to a variety of players. people on the Shura of Dioban who are teaching at Aligarh, like Akbar Abadi, very, very important players in the madrasa tradition. So that's where you learn a lot of things and you quickly grow out of this kind of starry-eyed view that one had had at the beginning of an idealistic place, but you see the place with all its complexities and its flaws. And so in many ways, my journey is an unusual journey because after 2.5, almost 3 years at Dioban, I realized that, you know, okay, Dioban has its limitations. It's going to drive me into a very kind of limited horizon of thinking. It involved a trip back to South Africa where I reevaluated myself and what I'm learning and how is that learning going to be relevant to the society I would want to serve. Now, what was very clear that when I got back from South Africa, or even when I left South Africa for the first time to come study in India, I knew that I want to serve, but what I wanted to serve, I was not very clear. And I think as I continued my journey in the madrasas, I realized that it's the journey of learning and the journey of knowledge that I want to serve. I did not see myself as a functionary in a mosque or, you know, working at an Islamic center or leading communities. But I quickly realized that that was where my energy was. And one of the first things I wanted to do is that I wanted to learn how to write. And I wanted to write in English. And so that in itself spurred me to read widely, to read broadly, and to explore other modalities of learning, such as reading in political science and English literature, side by side with my madrasa curriculum.
So one of the major strengths of this book is that it really gives the reader a very intimate picture of the daily educational and social life of students at madrasas. And the first chapter of your book, in fact, is titled Wake, Wash, Pray. I was wondering, we know that, you know, not every madrasa is alike. Of course, there is a lot of diversity and heterogeneity, as you show in your book. But could you walk us through a routine day at a South Asian madrasa? And what's the importance of disciplining the body to the religious and social imaginaries of the people and the students who populate madrasas?
You know, I can explain it through my own kind of discipline that was there. So one of the first things you learn in a madrasa is that knowledge without practice is in many ways fruitless or half achieved. In other words, all knowledge must have a relevance to one's life and to one's being, and it must have a purpose. And so in order to be the recipient of knowledge, you must also have the spiritual light in your heart and in your mind that will make that knowledge deliver on its fruits. And so in a life of practice, a life of prayer, a life of you know, observance of the major rituals, is quite vital. It's actually unthinkable. It's unthinkable that you will not have a life of practice. So a day starts in the following way. You start off in the morning, you know, at least half an hour before morning prayers, Fajr prayers. You'll be woken up by the warden. You get ready. You do your ablutions and you go to the mosque. If you go a bit earlier, you can recite some Quran. You can engage in meditation. You can do some dhikr. Then you will be a long morning prayer. Fajr prayer is always longer than the other ones because it's the stillness and the beginning of the day. It's a very, depending on the season, if it's winter, you know, places are kind of fairly frigid. If it's summer, it's actually very enjoyable and beautiful that time of the morning. And in South Asia, you know, mosques also have outer courtyards. So in summer, you pray in the courtyards and it's in the open and it's beautiful. It's a very tranquil environment. So your day starts in a beautiful way and you begin to feel the first impulses of the daybreak and your contact with nature and your contact with the divine and your body being cleansed. It's just a magical feeling in itself. And then you would read again Quran after Fajr. You would memorize passages that, or sections of the Quran. If you're a Hafiz al-Quran, you would at least read one juz, one part of 30 parts of the Quran in order to keep fresh. If you're not a Hafiz al-Quran, you would try and read as much of the Quran. Then you have breakfast. Then it'll be maybe an hour, 45 minutes before the first class begins and that continues until noon. You could have about two to three classes before noon. Noon, it's a quick lunch, and then you go and sleep. And especially in summer, you go and sleep in order to get a siesta. And then there is dhuhr prayers. The dhuhr prayers are slightly delayed. And after dhuhr prayers, there would be maybe a cup of tea and into class. That class then continues till asr time, and that's when the official day ends. So then you asr prayers, and then it's time for recreation. You either play a game, go for long walks. You go to a majlis that is a circle of any renowned teacher where they will have guests, and guests will be asking questions. You sit as part of that gathering, and you get a lot of kind of snippets of wisdom and insight. And generally, people don't encourage you to read any book or do any study between Asr and Maghrib. It's seen as a time complete kind of relaxation. And then Maghrib prayers, depending on the season, again, you would have your dinner before Maghrib, the Maghrib prayers. And after Maghrib, you start doing mutala, that is preparation for tomorrow's lesson, rehearsal of any lesson today that you might have had. Groups of students would sit. One student would take the lead. Some students are so good, they would actually be able to repeat the entire lesson that was taught by the teacher on the same day, do some, analysis of the text, and then preparation for tomorrow's lesson. And those are really energizing study groups. Because each one tries to show the skill, demonstrate the skill. That's also how the next generation of teachers are formed. And then you will have Isha prayers, and then after Isha prayers, there will be a further continuation of study groups or individual study, lots of reading. Also, lots of South Asia is chai world, not coffee, lots of chai and just friendship and building friendships, talking to other people, maybe engaging in more study or writing, and that's how you would go try and sleep at a kind of reasonable time in order to wake up fresh in the morning.
Now, among the major themes of this book, and something that you spend a lot of time discussing throughout the book, is the place and importance of knowledge. You just mentioned the relationship between knowledge and practice, but you actually spend a lot of time discussing the importance of knowledge itself in what you call the cosmology of ulama knowledge traditions. So could you speak a little about the conceptual and religious significance of knowledge as an intellectual and indeed as an embodied category in ulama traditions and in everyday madrasa life?
In the ulama tradition, ilm or knowledge is actually the way in which it is through knowledge that we are embodied, and it's through knowledge that we create a relationality with the divine. So ilm, that is knowledge, amal, that is practice, both together blend to form a relationship to the divine. So knowledge is not only about practice, but the practice is directed at the divine. So in some ways, the embodiment of ritual is actually to try to internalize the divine into yourself through practices. So in some ways, knowledge is an act of obedience. And that is such an important component of the madrasa tradition, that ilm is the sacrality of ilm. The sacrality of knowledge is that it's so closely related to obedience that knowledge is purity, is part of godliness. Knowledge in some ways is the fulcrum of godliness, because all other kinds of knowledge that preceded, the instrumental knowledge, that is your ability to read, your ability to write, your ability to get multiple disciplines under control, all leading to the discovery of the creator of the world. That is the centerpiece of knowledge. And therefore, in some ways, for many, that very idea of knowledge gets precisely distorted by this concentration of knowledge on the divine, as if nothing else matters. But thought of in a much more holistic way, all the other knowledge traditions of how to understand the world, how to get understand Arabic grammar, how to understand poetry, how to understand writing, how to learn these skills, how to get a sense of geography, of science, all this forms part of a cumulative whole. But that cumulative whole is always identified by its apogee, that is the knowledge of the divine, as if that light, you know, excludes all the other kinds of dimensions of the knowledge project. And therefore, there's often a kind of an intentional or unintentional skewing of what knowledge is in the madrasa tradition, so that sometimes one gets the impression that only knowledge of faith is a knowledge that is valued. And that's how madrasa representatives sometimes misrepresent themselves and the tradition. But in reality, this is the kind of superlative experience of knowledge.
Okay, let's move to the context of South Asia that forms the focus of this book. Can you give us a brief narrative of the key moments and events and figures that mark the intellectual history of madrasas in South Asia? I know this is a broad question, but could you sort of encapsulate, give us a snapshot of the key moments, events, and figures that populate this history?
Well, it seems that the earliest encounters of what we'd see as the kind of the proto-madrasa tradition, you know, begins at a very early period with the arrival of Islam in South Asia, either through Sindh or through Gujarat. And I think study circles or individuals, organize themselves in a way of transmitting learning over a particular period. But I think one of the ways to best illustrate what happens is to take it from, the 18th century or maybe the 17th century, where I think the major centers, and historically the major centers of learning in South Asia were, you know, Gujarat, the Deccan, North India, the areas of Multan, and I think of North India, I think of Delhi, I'm thinking of Agra, I'm thinking of Lahore, those areas right into Multan, those were over the Punjab, into the frontier areas, those were the kind of major nodes where the madrasa tradition was somewhat not as organized as we find it today, but students would go in search of a specialist. So people would go to Delhi to study with the hadith specialist, go to Jaunpur to study with the Arabic grammar specialist, travel to, Khairabad to go study logic, or go to Multan to study tafsir, that is Quran exegesis. So students would be itinerant to follow the expertise of teachers and experts. By the time in the 18th century, one can think of Shah Waliullah, the 18th century sage and major influential figure in South Asia. His father had a madrasa, Madrasa Rahimiya, and it seemed that they began to put under one roof multiple scholars where, these scholars could teach more than one discipline to a group of students. And of course, the madrasas that we have today and the form and the shape, in my view, takes its stamp and its imprint from the Farangi Mahal School that also, was shaped in the 18th century in the city of Lucknow. And it seemed that the Farangi Mahal School became the model of the madrasa. But that was a kind of a family franchise in the 18th century. One family and its scholars offering services. And as I mentioned in the book, Shibli Nomani, the great reformist traditionalist, referred to Farangi Mahal as, this is the Cambridge of India. And that is a very quaint identification of Farangi Mahal, because it is as quaint and small and dainty as Cambridge is compared to, say, American universities. But we're very, very kind of detailed. Islamic humanities are studied in those places, Arabic grammar, philosophy, logic, kind of some in the Farangi Mahal curriculum, you had some, you know, one book on tafsir, maybe one book on Islamic law, a very little on hadith, but mostly the kind of humanities, Islamic humanities were taught there. And the big shift then takes place with the founding of Dioban in the last quarter of the 19th century, where the Dioban school adopts a certain kind of British administrative, grid and format in order to organize the gradations of study according to certain texts and years, and also a certification at the end, and with a proper administration and salaries for teachers and stipends for students in a particular way. And it seems that the improvisation on the Farangi Mahal curriculum but also the improvisation of the bureaucracy and administration of madrasas lays the foundation stone of the madrasa. So it's both these moments from the 18th century to the 19th century, the events as post the Indian Rebellion, and the figures that we are talking about, you know, Farangi Mahal, the kind of major actors there is Mullah Nizamuddin, and then his very, very, dedicated followers, his son, his nephews, and others who, carry the torch of learning from the Farangi Mahal school. And then you have in Dioban, of course, people like Qasim Nanotvi, Rashid Ahmad Gangoi, and Haji Abid Hussain, who are the kind of the troika of the founders. But, you know, the students, the very next generation are people like Mahmoud Hassan, known as Sheikhul Hind, who is both a scholar, activist, political activist. And that, I think, creates a variety of students in the second, third generation of Dioban that generates its own kind of dynamics.
So let's now move to the curriculum or the kinds of texts which are studied and learned in madrasas. And this might be an aspect which might be most unfamiliar to people from outside madrasa traditions. Could you discuss and describe a bit the kinds of texts which students in South Asian madrasas, for example, read and master, and how did the curriculum evolve and come to be what it is today? And also if you could discuss a bit how these texts are taught and learned on a daily basis in madrasas.
Yeah. So these texts are a text that were written, you know, as far back as the 11th, 12th century in the Gregorian calendar to the 18th century texts in Arabic. Some were written in Persian. And, you know, these texts are taught line by line. So you read a text line by line, then there's commentary line by line. Now, obviously, the idea is to teach the student how to negotiate the text. So it is the philological approach that is about words, it's about meanings, it's about language, and about ideas and the worlds that language creates. So if there's anywhere that you can say where the philological tradition of Islam still exists and where it flourishes, it's still in the South Asian madrasa systems. I mean, in the variety of the madrasa systems. So you would take a text, Shurun Bulali's text on called Nurul Idah, the light that clarifies, which is a text on your primer on Islamic law, Hanafi law. And so you would start with the opening of the text, the hamd and thana, the praise of to God and the remembrance and the indebtedness that the scholar has for those who had all his benefactors. And there will be a very careful grammatical analysis of why he used that word and not that word. What does this word imply? What kind of theological signals does the author try to send by using this word and not another word? And then you slowly break into the substance of what the author is talking about. Teachers who be teaching that book obviously know the kind of next level of detail of one particular line. So it will say, for instance, you know, water is found in these different types. And then it would, in your Prima text, it will just basically mention the waters, no particular details of it, just mention them. The teacher would then analyze, and to the extent that the teacher thinks it's relevant to give you the next level of detail, they will give it. Otherwise, the goal is that you must be able to navigate the reading, the grammar, and understanding of this text. So in the beginning, the text is read very slowly, and so you might only read two lines per day. It depends also on the proficiency of the students' linguistic ability. And then slowly the pace would increase, and then you would begin to get control of a larger body of information on a particular topic. And that's how every book starts. Most of the kind of law books, Islamic law books, the fiqh books, start with a discussion on ceremonial purity. A tafsir book would start on commentary of an exegesis of the Quran. So you start with the opening chapter, Surah Fatiha, and again the kind of detailed analysis. So this is how these texts are taught. And obviously, every year of study, you have a gradation of a text of greater complexity in each subject level. So after Nurul Irah comes the study of Quduri. After Quduri comes the study of Kanzu Daqaiq. After Kanzu Daqaiq, you study Sharh al-Wiqaya. After Sharh al-Wiqaya, you study al-Hidayah. And Hidayah in the Hanafi tradition is the kind of the fulcrum of the fiqh tradition. And that's what you will have in every discipline. And that's how the texts are taught in a very kind of didactic fashion.
You know, one of the things that I began thinking about as I was reading your book is, the relationship between the things that we teach in classrooms and the social lives or the campus life of students. Oftentimes one wonders, how are these students internalizing things that we're teaching them? And is this informing, for example, conversations and other aspects of their extracurricular lives on campuses? And you provide some very interesting examples of this relationship between the texts that the madrasa students read and their everyday lives on madrasa campuses, whereas sometimes you provide examples of moments when particular texts seem very distant to the social imaginaries of students, these texts from many centuries ago that they read, and other times when they seemed much more captivated on a much more personal basis, what they were reading and what they were discussing in classes. So could you share some of these examples in talking about the larger relationship between the texts that are read and the everyday lives of madrasa students on madrasa campuses?
You know, I'm thinking back about my own experience, and I realized that these texts really require a certain amount of preparation, a certain maturity, a certain level of understanding what is the world before these texts can really have an impact. As I say in the book that, you know, I really began to value this tradition, even, you know, immensely after graduation. Once I began to realize that they offer something, that they offer something of tradition. In other words, once I became a humanist. Now, you are absolutely right to have observed that sometimes the text is very distant from your own life experience. But sometimes, you know, there will be a moment in which, you know, one can use a text and talk about, you know, a particular act of ritual. So, for instance, the author of Kanzu Daqaiq says that, you know, that an-nikahu sunnatun wa inda tawqani wajibun, that, you know, marriage is a encouraged practice of the Prophet, it's a sunnah. But when you have a surfeit of passion and sexual energy, then it becomes obligatory, okay? And then we are all young boys and young men, and you know, you have all kinds of, you know, experiences. And in Islamic law, that if you have a nocturnal emission, then you have to take a ritual bath. And then, you know, in the mornings, young men run to the bathroom with a bucket in a hand and trying to look for warm water, take a bath. And then some people will be saying, you know, وَإِنْدَ تُوْقَانِ وَاجِبٌ, you know, and, you know, at this, that when these energies push too hard, then maybe marriage is a good example and be good, you know, a titter and mutual kind of jesting. And that's where, but you know, many of the practices of, you know, how do you pray? Do you raise your hands between the various prostrations or don't you? Or is the hadith more stronger on this matter of raising your hands or not raising your hands? Is the Hanafi school right? Do the Shafis not have a better position on this? That will be a constant conversation. You know, how do you, you know, the recitation of certain verses and passages? Is it correct? Is it the correct form of reading in terms of tajweed? In interpretation of hadith materials. And these are ongoing conversations that do have an impact on your interpretation. So, for instance, if you came across a reference, you will find the author of a text that is not taught, but is a reference text, the, say, Kasani, who is the author of Badai or Sinai, a major reference work, he somewhere there mentions that he doesn't really, or some scholar doesn't really approve of child marriage, okay? And these issues become quickly relevant to the life around you. The question, when I was in India, it was a state of emergency the first couple of years, Mrs. Gandhi, political repression, and then there was this whole question of, you know, forced sterilization. What is the moral status of forced sterilization? Can a Muslim allow him or herself to be sterilized voluntarily or by state? What is the relationship to the body? You know, all these ethical dilemmas come up. I mean, how do you pray when you're traveling on the train? All these day-to-day practices of ritual that are, you know, resplendent in Muslim life, those issues come up on a day-to-day basis. And so, you are reading, you're trying to understand, you're trying to, you know, what's the place of television? Can you use media? Everything is related to life in one or the other way. And these debates continue within madrasa communities.
Let us talk a bit about contemporary madrasas and education that you also discuss quite extensively in your book. And you mentioned that as part of your research, you audited a number of classes in both male and female madrasas across India and Pakistan. Can you talk a little about some of your observations from these classes? What most captured your attention in terms of pedagogy, learning, and the diversity of educational approaches that you found in these madrasas?
So, you know, I mean, I could access the male madrasas very directly, but the female madrasas, a former student of mine, she went into a female madrasa, and I know of another scholar, female scholar, who had been there, so I used some of their insights in describing what happens in female madrasas. So, you know, one of the observations I had was that the methodology and the way students are taught today compared to my education 30 years ago, in many ways, very similar. I mean, I didn't see, you know, there might be a madrasa over there, but I didn't see the use of, you know, an overhead projector. I didn't see the use of, you know, multimedia. I mean, what I did see is that there are now computer banks and places where students can do things, but the classroom is kind of, you know, very similar, and the organization is similar. What I did observe was that the pedagogical approaches that different teachers used in 30 years ago, you find that variety today too. So, Some professors would use this opportunity to in the classroom to basically give a lecture and really, you know, dazzle the students by making connections, by talking about relevant issues in today's world, connecting it to politics. And other teachers will be very much focused on the text. So for some professors, the text becomes a pretext for a larger conversation. And for others, the text is basically an opportunity to drill down into the tradition, to open up, you know, new dimensions of the text, to find, you know, different ways of connecting the dots to previous lessons, to previous thematics in the text. And so there's this, you know, diversity. Some teachers have a combination of both doing this kind of fine-grained work, but also trying to give you the big picture. Others just give you the big picture of the text and say, you know, you can read the text by yourself, or your Arabic is proficient enough. So I think that the in many ways the pedagogical approaches have remained similar. In a few areas, they've taken out difficult texts and replaced them with easier ones. And some of the philosophy texts have been completely excised because they are way too difficult and for students today and really don't make any kind of connections. So they might use one text in philosophy and many of the madrasas. Obviously, the best is, you know, kept for last, and that is the study of hadith. So while you might have in your penultimate year some study of hadith, in the final year of a madrasa curriculum, in today's madrasas, you will have students studying the six canonical Sunni books of hadith. At first, very slowly, but then towards the end, the goal is to finish the book so that the student can get ijaza, can get permission and certification to teach others, and also to pass on the baton of authorizing the student to teach this book. And that's how knowledge passes from heart to heart, from person to person.
Just a quick follow-up question to that, Dr. Musa. In the book, you also talk about your own suggestions or your own observations of how the madrasa tradition and the curriculum could be modified, or ways in which the texts are progress in the 6 years could be changed and so on. As a traditional scholar, you make certain observations of how to make the curriculum itself more dynamic and speak to other knowledge traditions. Could you share briefly some of those things that you mentioned in the book in terms of your own suggestions, your own suggestions to make the curriculum more dynamic?
Yeah, no, I think the Nizami curriculum would possibly be best served as a kind of a graduate curriculum where the student is well prepared in Arabic language, get the kind of, you know, foundations in various disciplines, have a good sense of philology and the humanities, broadly speaking, especially deep grounding in, say, for instance, you know, language and modern language. And then you tackle those texts. Those texts will then, you know, speak a different message, provide a very different message, at least in terms of the intellectual output, right? So then one will have a better appreciation of what the Muslim medieval scholars were trying to achieve. Then the value of their work will increase, you know, millionfold, I believe, because then one will have a sense of that, and also studied with history, with a historical sensibility of what was going on. So the success of the madrasa tradition now is that what it does, it inducts you into a tradition, but you are largely intellectually not that literate, not literate to the extent that you could have been. Because I think the approach assumes too much right now, and the students are not prepared to optimize from the text. And the way of in which these texts are taught right now is that they induct you into a tradition. And the idea is that your relationship to the text and to the past is one that inducts you into piety and a life of devotion. And that's what I call the Republic of Piety. But I think you need both. You require the Republic of Letters and Learning together with the Republic of Devotion and Piety. And the two go together. And I think one is achieved at the expense of the other. So therefore, I'm saying that a good grounding in the humanities and some of the social sciences in a kind of an undergraduate program with language, Arabic and Persian, then the Nizami curriculum, it will have a profound outcome in terms of appreciation of the tradition and the reading of the tradition, and also the knowledge production of scholars and scholarship in South Asia. And therefore, I remain so hopeful that the real solution to the knowledge crisis still lies with those communities, but only on condition that they are done in a different register, and they're done with a different method and approach.
So let us move to the final part of the book, which is on the contemporary geopolitics surrounding madrasas and discourses on madrasas. So what do you find most problematic, Dr. Musa, if you could pinpoint, about the contemporary popular and media discourses about madrasas? And what kind of a corrective do you see yourself offering in this book?
You know, I mean, to put it bluntly, I mean, it's a sheer ignorance of observers just because they see people, you know, looking different and, you know, wearing different and studying a universe that they can't relate to. They equate that, those madrasas equate that to terrorism. Just because the Taliban or some of the people related to the Taliban has studied in madrasas doesn't mean that all the madrasas are Taliban-esque. Most of the madrasas are not. There are, you know, a dozen or so madrasas in Pakistan that openly identify with the Taliban. But those madrasas, you know, are sui generis. The majority of the madrasas, you know, don't engage in militant activities. Yes, they are critical of American foreign policy. The Bareilly madrasas don't even identify with the Taliban. They consider the Taliban to be the scourge. The Salafis, you know, pay very little attention to the kind of the politics of that region. They might be more interested in the politics of say other parts of the world, or they want to combat the Deobandi influence, whatever the case may be. So there are different projects. What I'm saying is that the demonization of the madrasas is one thing that is bred out of pure ignorance and based on sketchy reports of people who, you know, claim to be scholars who interviewed a number of people who associated with madrasas, and therefore they are associated with the war in Kashmir, and that they are freedom fighters, and then they turn into terrorists. And the truth of the matter is that the madrasas are doing something very different. And nowadays, you find, you know, television shows like Homeland and others quickly identifying terrorists going to a madrasa. So in these HBO shows and so on, you will see madrasas now being seen as demonic. And I think that that is the corrective that I'm offering is a factual corrective. I'm taking them and telling them what exactly they study, how they study the text, what they do. Do they have political views? Yes. Do they have political views that are not America friendly? Yes. But that has never been a sin, and that has never been an offense. And that has not been a reason to consider other people to be demonic. Rather, it should be a wake-up call for America to get its act together and show a much more friendlier face on the world stage as to how it would like the world to view it. And then it must deliver that in terms of the actions it does on the world stage, rather than invading countries and, you know, and assassinating people around the world, which has been, you know, part of the actions of multiple administrations in since 9/11. And so I think one has to separate the political fallout from what is actually taking place within madrasas.
You end this book on a rather curious note by writing a few letters to Western and US policymakers and to your own former madrasa teachers. Could you share with us some of the highlights of what you wrote in these letters and to whom were these letters addressed?
Yeah, so you know, I'm the one letter is kind of a generic letter addressed to any U.S. president and to members of Congress, and trying to tell them that, you know, you're making a big mistake in terms of policy practices and policy directives by thinking of madrasas as demonic places, as dangerous places. You are basically, it's a self-defeating project, and that those are live communities. These communities preach to millions of people. And if you show hostility towards them, they are going to return the compliment in hostility. And there's no reason for you to view them as hostile. You need to understand what role they play. And you also need to hear, I'm trying to tell governments, U.S. government, but governments around the world, that you need to hear what Orthodox religious leaders are saying about how they see the world. If you only want to force your view of how the world is or supposed to be on others, that's not going to work. You need to see how the world is viewed through people living in different spaces, having different horizons, and having different visions of what life on Earth is. If you're not going to get that, if you're not going to appreciate that, then you're going to miss a lot, and it's only going to result in greater harm in inter-civilizational, intercultural communication. For my teachers, I'm trying to share with them both my debt to them, that I wouldn't be the person I am today without that very, very formative education that I got. I'm very proud of that imprint on my soul, on my being, of being a student of this very, impressive tradition, a tradition that has, formed millions of people as part of a living tradition still today. And therefore, I'm showing on one hand my debt. On the other, I'm also trying to share that who I have become and what I would like to channel back and say, don't view knowledge of the humanities and the social sciences, the kind of knowledge that I've also embraced and hopefully trying to create the synthesis of different knowledge streams that address, our human dilemma in much more complex ways. Don't view that as anathema. Don't view those knowledge traditions and knowledge of the other in a hostile fashion. For them also, I'm telling them that will be self-defeating. The way out would be to be much more judicious, to be much more open, to be experimental, and to listen to the other. And so I take two teachers. One is Maulana Abdul Khalid Madrasi, was a young professor at the time when I studied. He was clearly, someone who inspired me a great deal, a master of the Arabic language. He was always critical, about madrasa practices, that has always resonated with me, and that way also, motivated me to think outside the box. And another is and Maulana Khalid Madrasi today is one of the deputy vice chancellors at Dioban, madrasa, and he's doing important things for the school. I'm trying to remind him that once upon a time he was a great advocate of curriculum reform. And I'm asking him, and gently nudging him to say, maybe that is something that you want to address again. And the other one is, Mullah Sayyid Salman Husseini Nadvi, head of Sharia studies at Darul Ulum Nadwatul Ulama. That's where I finally graduated, because I didn't complete my studies at Dioban. I went to another college, which is Nadwatul Ulama, in a bigger city with a different kind of orientation, but today almost identical to Dioban in many ways. Salman Nadvi is a outspoken advocate of Islam. Sometimes people view him as upping the temperature a bit with his rhetoric. He's also been thinking about curriculum reform and been saying that knowledge should be seen in a much more capacious way and not in this narrow way that only knowledge only leads to piety, but that knowledge that leads to the discovery of God and relationship with God also requires a much more broader base. And that broader base would actually strengthen our relationship to the divine. But he, on the other hand, he's made also some kind of noises that almost sounded that he's one on the way, advising ISIS to not be so violent and killing fellow Muslims, and a kind of a subtle admiration also going on there. So I'm telling him, also, that I'm worried about what I'm seeing you doing. That sends very mixed signals. And, he's been extremely burdened by the failure of the Arab Spring. And he sees things in such absolute terms that, the darkness that has befallen the Muslim world. And he blames a lot of other actors for that, including the West. And so he's very critical about that. And so, but in many ways, he's also representative of a larger audience out there, and he has a lot of clout. So in some ways, I'm trying to start a conversation with that and say, don't think about the immediate present, but also one way that as a traditionalist, one thinks about the future beyond the present. And in the same way that you look to the past, the distant past, as ways of nourishing the self, look at the distant future and the role that you might want to play. So don't go for instantaneous gratification and don't go for quick fixes. And in some ways, some streams in the madrasa world has been infected by the modernist impulse to have quick fixes, to go for instant gratification. And I'm saying that, you know, I'm trying to have a conversation and say, think beyond the immediate and think about the long-term objectives and try to preserve rather than confront.
So as we're coming to the end of our time today, I was wondering if you could share with us what kinds of projects are you working on these days and what could we expect to read from you and learn from you in the coming months and years?
Well, I mean, it might be a little bit premature, but, you know, I've been for long, you know, working on some essays, how to think about Islamic law and ethics in the world in which we are living, what kind of questions we need to pay attention to. So, I mean, there's a big book and a small book. I think there's a one book that I'm writing is meant to start a conversation with a broad audience. And another a book is one where I'm becoming a bit more technical and trying to work through questions of reason, notions of the body, notions of time, space, political systems, and the way in which Islamic law plays a role there. And, you know, is it law? Is it ethical? And, you know, there's been quite a bit of a conversation about that. Wael Hallaq's book, you know, Wael Hallaq wrote many books on Islamic law, but now he's talking about law as ethics and self-formation. And that's something that I've also seen in my work, that it might be a much more, you know, fruitful approach. And then I want to go back to Ghazali. I'm just reading, you know, parts of Ghazali again, and there's so much that I missed the first time, and I guess I will miss more if I read it the second and third time. But I want to talk about Ghazali law, language, and the ethical and the legal. And so, you know, back to the language issue. So I'm really energized by the return to the humanities and the philological. And in part, it's got to do possibly with my very brief time at Notre Dame, where there's a lot of, you know, energy and excitement about the humanities and the humanistic tradition and a philology. And so I think this place at Notre Dame is very engaged with the real world out there as a Catholic institution, but also the real world through a knowledge tradition. And I think I'm benefiting from this environment here. And so having very productive conversations about questions of religion and practice and society and the world. And, you know, how does scholarship play a role in directing events in the world, or at least we think we do. So a couple of projects in a nutshell. It's ethics and back to Ghazali and language.
What is a Madrasa, published by Professor Ibrahim Musa, written by Professor Ibrahim Musa and published by the University of North Carolina Press in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Thank you so much, Dr. Musa, for your time and for this wonderful book and this excellent conversation. I'm sure our listeners would really have benefited from your insights. And thank you so much for this book and for this conversation.
Well, Shirley, first of all, thank you for your time and for taking the trouble to read the book and also to conduct this interview. I hope there's something of benefit to your readers, and I hope to engage them in a conversation. I said that, you know, I will dedicate some of my website, Dehlis, to a conversation with people who are interested in continuing a dialogue with this book. So I invite your listeners to do that, and I want to again show my deep appreciation and thanks to you for engaging me in such a productive manner. Thank you.
So this was my conversation with Professor Ibrahim Musa on his important new book, What is a Madrasa?, published by the University of North Carolina Press in 2015. Please also join us next time for another new episode of New Books in Islamic Studies. Until then, stay well and take care.